With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
How you doing, Matt?
Fast. That was a quick answer, man. You were there, armed and ready, weren't you?
Yeah, we've been trying to get... We're planning to go to the States. My family, we're going to go to the States for a couple of weeks in August. And boy, I've never had to do so many different checks and balances to try and make it work. It's a pain in the ass. Probably be a lot easier just not to go. But I'm sitting outside where hopefully this will work, because... once this lockdown happened, it's just like my cell signal got crap. The internet is crap. It's not. I'm not thrilled about it, but can you hear me all right now?
Yeah, man. I got you loud and clear. So, I mean, how have you been managing with business and keeping in contact with all the people you need to be keeping in contact with? Has it been a nightmare?
It has. It's just the times of day, you know. If you're talking technology-wise, it's like, you know, it's hit or miss, so... when I'm calling people in the States, I'm usually calling in the evening when, you know, the internet's not so bad and stuff. I mean, I've been able to communicate with pretty much everyone quite easily. It's just, obviously, to do something like this. And a couple months ago, I did like a live stream of a performance of this record I put out. And I got really lucky with that, because that was worked out pretty flawlessly using the Facebook Live. But anytime I've been trying to do live streams, DJ stuff on Instagram, it's just a nightmare. So, but Instagram's not really the best for live streaming. It's just the easiest because everyone's on Instagram. But yeah, it's all been good. You know, I can't complain. My family is safe and healthy, and so can't complain.
I think it's been like a very specific journey for each specific individual and their specific set of circumstances. For me, it's been really tough because I'm single. A lot of my friends are married with kids, and I feel like everybody I've spoken to who has a family has actually found this process really quite positive and rewarding in many ways, because it's given a lot of people quality time with their partners, with their kids, with everything else removed. Whereas from my side of the fence, it's like all my sort of social life and activity is based around DJing out and about and touring and doing these podcast things, but face to face and connecting with people on that level. And when you take all that away, I was like, fuck, it's just me in a flat in London. And even when you're in London, all the kind of positives that London has to offer have been taken away as well. So it's been a mad time.
Yeah, I feel for you, man. I feel for you. And that's the thing, is especially with, I've got some friends in New York who, you know, the Fun Loving Criminal DJ who comes on tour with us, he lost a leg years ago, and he's not found it easy either. And, you know, I think the mental health side of things is what you got to really pay attention to. And I mean, with my daughter, it's just been really kind of imperative to just talk about feelings and stuff, even though she doesn't want to.
Yeah.
And just, you know, I talked to her about it. I said, how are you feeling? She's like, well, it's all shit, isn't it? So she's definitely learned to drop some new words she shouldn't be saying, but we kind of allow it. But yeah, I mean, I've got friends that, you know, don't have, you know, or like yourselves, they're by themselves, and it hasn't been easy. I mean, and especially now that things are sorting, slowly trying to go back to normal, it just feels odd, you know, and it's, I just feel bad for that it came down to this, that it got so bad, but, you know, can't point fingers because it's just hard enough these days to even know what to believe.
Yeah.
You know, it depends what newspaper or news show you're watching and stuff, and the conspiracy people are just loving it and going to town. And yeah, it's a state of fear that I'm just really trying to just not let my daughter feel it. She feels it.
How old's your daughter, Fast?
She's 9 years old. So right. she's
definitely old enough to be aware of everything that's going on, and obviously probably missing her friends a lot. And
she knows all about it. And, you know, that's the one thing we kind of got her. We got her, she has an iPad, so we hooked her up with the FaceTime and her Roblox to be able to play with her friends and stuff, but it's not the same. And then the problem with that is that just eats up the bandwidth in the house. So whenever she's on her games or FaceTime with her friends, we can't go on the internet. And my wife is working from home. So, you know, it's, things have been easier, but, you know, we're surviving, you know, so we're not. I taught my daughter how to ride a bike. So I guess that's one of the many good things that's happened during this lockdown. But yeah, it's just odd. You know, I do bookings for these restaurants in London called the Rum Kitchen. And, you know, all the DJs were basically just instantly put out of work. You know, you're a DJ yourself, and anyone who's live musicians, it's like our world is just kind of shut down for a long time, it seems. But we finally, with the government's guidelines to be able to have music playing in restaurants again, it was great to be able to get these DJs back into the Rum Kitchen. But of course, one of the locations is in Soho, and within 2 hours of the DJ playing at a very low volume, the council came in and shut them down and basically said, you can't have DJs or we're going to close the restaurant. So their 43-page guidelines on having music is definitely not written by someone who I would say even listens to music, because, you know, one of the rules is you can't have music above speaking volume. Fair enough. And the good thing about that is the more people are drinking, the louder they get. So the music can get a bit louder. So we can work with that. But the fact that one of the guidelines said, you cannot play any music that encourages singing or dancing.
Yeah.
And it's odd because I've been DJing around at these places the past few weeks, you know, and there's hosts that basically have to go up to people when they're just kind of moving in their chair, eating some food, and they go up and be like, can you please not dance? So it's just all strange. It's all just a strange new world.
I've been holding back because a lot of friends of mine who DJ have been, you know, saying to me, why don't you get online and do like Twitch.
Twitch and all that.
Live streams. But for me, I mean, if you're a musician, I can see why you do that. But for me as a DJ, I see so little value and point in visually live streaming a set. Like, I've been making mixes like I do every week for my Patreon page, and I'll put them up for people to listen to. But the idea of watching a DJ on a screen and you don't have any crowd in front of you to vibe off, for me, just feels like a really, I don't know, a fruitless task. Where do you stand on the whole like live streaming of DJ sets?
I think like a lot of my DJ friends, we were loving it. We're not loving it, but we were enjoying it the first month or so into this. You know, I was doing different things because this, like you said, there's so many DJs doing it and there's so many real good DJs doing it that, you know, I like DJing. I wouldn't consider myself in any upper tier of like skilled DJs like a Mr. Thing or, you know, some of these awesome DJs, a lot of them being from the UK. But I was doing different things. So I was like, I did a stream one night where I just played the Apocalypse Now soundtrack.
Amazing. I think I saw that on your Instagram feed. Yeah.
Which is cool because the vinyl of it is basically just, it's a double vinyl that's just the whole movie. I mean, they got all the dialogue in it.
Oh, wow.
So it was amazing. And it's just one of my favorite vinyls I own. The vinyl of it's just awesome. But then I was doing some streaming for the Rum Kitchen, which is cool. And I enjoyed it. But, you know, there's maybe 100 people check it out for like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
So it's like, what's the point? And, you know, when I did my little, I have this record I put out called Sadage, that's kind of like an ambient instrumental record, and very much like kind of Blade Runner meets Brian Eno and stuff. And I wanted to do a performance of that. I was supposed to do one for this friend of mine who does live sessions, but he obviously got canceled because of lockdown. So I said, okay, I want to do it over Easter weekend. And that was great because I was able to actually do a performance. And I was really surprised at how many people actually were watching it live and watched it later. And it was fun to do, but it was also, you know, like I said, I got lucky because Facebook Live was the only one that I could broadcast it live in stereo, which was like essential because I'm doing balance sweeps with the sounds and sound effects and stuff. So I really just got lucky with it because any other time I've been trying to do live streams, you know, it's been cut off or the buffer gets all screwed up. So it's made it complicated. But like, I think at the same time, me and a bunch of other DJ friends who've been doing it just said, yeah, there's no point.
It's an interesting record, that one is, mate, and I really enjoyed it. And it reminded me in many ways, you should probably check this out. You know the guy from Limp Bizkit, Wes Borland?
Yes.
So he's done a similar couple of records in a very similar vein of like soundtracky, ambient, electronic, purely instrumental records under the moniker Crystal Machete. And it's a really similar, totally, you know, it's a million miles away from Limp Bizkit. And it's fantastic. And it's, you know, that kind of perfect headphone record that you can just put on like with yours and just get lost in it. And, you know,
it's funny because I, you know, every now and then I've never really been a fan of Limp Bizkit. They've got some tracks that, you know, are definitely, they rock, but I've always been a fan of Wes. I always think he's just a very unique, awesome guitar player. So the past couple of months, I actually got to confess, I was watching footage of him playing in Rio and playing all over the world, you know, with him playing guitar. Only when he's playing, I know that he left the group for a bit. But yeah, I'll definitely check that out. I mean, I always love Brian Eno's ambient stuff, and Vangelis, Blade Runner is like my favorite soundtrack in the world. So yeah, I always collected all these instrumental, you know, these songs I was writing that were never going to be for FLC or even for some other project. But then I kind of compiled it the end of last year and put it out as sort of like this kind of audio meditation thing, which is when I did my live stream, I liked using the dialogue of Alan Watts over it because it just kind of seemed like it was fitting for what everyone was going through at the time. But I think early on, you know, in April, people were still kind of like going with the flow of the lockdown, trying to make the most of it, almost in certain ways, excited.
Are you still there, bud? You just cut off a second ago. Fast.
Now here we are, middle of July.
Sorry, dude. You just cut off after you said people were excited about the start of lockdown. I don't know what happened. Your phone just dipped out, if you wouldn't mind rewinding. I felt like that as well. I was like, at the start of it, I was like, this is kind of a social experiment. It's a time to pause, reflect. And for the first month, maybe even into the second, I was happy. But then it's like the longer it went on and the less likely anything seems to be, you know, getting back on track, the more crushing it's been. But yeah, sorry, where were you at? What were you saying?
Yeah, no, I think exactly the same thing. You basically just summed up what I was saying. It was like, you know, as far as like homeschooling my daughter, we like set up all sorts of little games out in the backyard and to do PE and all that. And it was almost borderline fun for a while. But then after a few weeks of that, it just wore off. And then May was just sort of a non-month. But it's amazing how fast the time is gone. I mean, here we are, middle of July, and it's like, I don't see where it's going. I mean, just, you know, I booked a flight to the States a month ago, and it's just been, I mean, there isn't a week that goes by, there isn't something has gotten canceled or moved or changed. And I know in the States, you know, the numbers are rising, everyone's getting all upset. And, you know, I don't know at what point are you supposed to just say, all right, well, I'm just going to hunker down in my house and just make sure I live. Or you're going to actually say, well, I need to live. So as long as I can kind of play it as safe as I can, you know, that's the better option. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I'm trying to do all this through my daughter's eyes to try and make it as least, you know, harmful for her mental health as possible. And I think that's important, but it's hard. It's not easy, you know. And for as far as the bands and stuff, you know, with FLC, we had loads of gigs canceled, like every other band. We had tours set up for February that have been pushed to the fall, that who knows if, you know, fall next year, who knows if those will even happen. And it's just strange, because obviously I think as humans, they need to listen to music, they need to get out, they need to dance, they need to sing songs, they need to go to concerts and be close to people and all that. And that just seems to be the big no-no at the moment. And at what point is it going to get back to normal? I don't know.
I think as well, like for me, the idea of socially distancing at a gig is like soul destroying. Like I would sooner just wait until you can mingle and enjoy it as you should. Even with pubs, because I'm a big fan of the hospitality industry. I worked in it for many years. Obviously, when you DJ in that world, you're a part of it anyway. And you know, coming up in the clubs in New York, like it's a lifestyle around that. And that doesn't just mean like drinking and drugging and partying. It's the social element and the community that forms around these venues and bars. And I have been going out to pubs and restaurants now they've reopened, but some of them are so laborious in their approach to, you know, the safe distancing rules. You've got to like get the app, you've got to download that.
You've got
to order from your phone. Everywhere has their own rules. And it's almost like, oh, this isn't enjoyable in any way. I'd sooner just have a couple of friends round to the garden and have some cans out there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is that even with restaurants open, it just seems kind of like this somber feeling.
Yeah.
But who knows? I mean, I hope that it's just over the course of the next few months, it just kind of loosens up a bit more. There isn't anything crazy. I mean, with all the protests that were going on and everything, you would have thought that these numbers would have skyrocketed. And I think in the States, when I'm seeing how, you know, they're being reported on the news as if it's just through the roof, like they're still in their first phase, and it's like, it's just getting worse, you know, the first wave of the, you know, the virus. But it's just weird. The whole thing is just odd.
I was hoping to do one of these face-to-face with you, man. And I want to give a shout.
I know, it would have been nice.
I want to give a shout out to our mutual friend, Dawn, for introducing us and setting this up. And I'll tell you the quick story of how I met Dawn, and then maybe we can, you know, jump into your, you know, FLC and all the rest of your story. But so I was out in Amsterdam at the end of a tour, which I just completed in February, with a band called Zach Sabbath. And that is like, it's...
Yeah, I know them.
You know the crew, so you know Joey and Blasco and Zach Wild and those guys. So I was out with them DJing before their set, just playing like, you know, classic rock and metal and party tunes, just to kind of get the crowd amped up. And then the last show was at the, what's the venue that Dawn works at in Amsterdam?
Paradiso.
The last show was at that. And so the next day, I'd booked 2 days at the end of the tour to stay on in Amsterdam and just kind of cut loose and have some fun. Because I don't know about you, but when I finish a tour, I hate to just return straight away to normality. I find it a bit too much of like a brutal post-tour come down shock, so I quite like to take a couple of days afterwards to like unwind in the city that I'm in and, you know, reflect on the journey and everything. So I booked these 2 days in Amsterdam, all excited to have a good time out on my own. And then I woke up the next morning after the show and had a text from a friend who sent me this news article. And it was a friend of mine who was a previous guest on this show. She was like a clinical therapist and a psychologist and just a beautiful person. And she'd been murdered by an ex-partner. And so I got the link to this news story that morning, and it was just the most crushing, devastating, heartbreaking news. I'm on my own in this city. Obviously, I'd been traveling on the bus with all these guys, so I'd had this family around me for 2 weeks, and then I'm there, like, isolated, alone, processing this just horrific news. And so I just went to this Irish pub on the corner of that square where the Paradiso is, and just... Yep. Started having some drinks and just like basically crying into my pint, you know, like really heavy stuff. Yeah. And Dawn was at the bar, and I guess she could sense I was sad, so she just struck up a conversation. And it was one of those moments where initially I was like, oh, I really don't want to talk to anyone because I'm grieving and going through this. But she was really there for me in a moment when I needed someone, and she ended up just basically taking me under her wing for the day. And we had a bunch of drinks, and she let me stay at her house, and we just kind of like formed this really fast sweet friendship in a really short space of time, and it was lovely, and she was amazing, and just like, you know, there when I really needed someone. And then she was like, well, I should get some people that I know onto your show. And she was like, the first person I can think of is Fast, because you and him would hit it off like a house on fire. And I was like, awesome. And then obviously with everything that's been happening, because we've been talking about doing this since like March,
for months, yeah,
I guess.
Exactly.
But yeah, what a sweetheart she is. How did you guys meet?
Yeah, she's amazing. So you met Cooper then?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's a great dog. He's a great dog. Yeah, well, we've known Dawn for many years through Paradiso, because we try to play at the Paradiso maybe once a year or every 2 years, and we've been very fortunate to play there actually two nights in a row the past few years. So we've always had great gigs there, and she's always been super kind and cool, and hooks us up with the after parties for doing some DJing and stuff. And she's been super helpful with me when I put out my Sadazi record and got me some, you know, set me up with you and set me up with a couple other people, which is very cool. I mean, that must be her Irish side, right?
Yeah, man. That generosity, that spirit, that warmth. And also as well, it's a big part of, I think, people who are lifers, who, you know, when people think of the music industry, they obviously think of the performers. But obviously behind the performers is the, you know, the tour managers, the road crew, the venue staff, these people that are like the blood and sweat of this industry that have obviously been affected, arguably even more so than the artist, because the artist can hopefully at least generate some kind of, either through merch or like streaming, you know, live performances, they can hopefully generate a little bit of income, whereas the people who are behind the scenes, they don't have that infrastructure, that fan base, and they're just kind of left there. Like, obviously some of them are on furlough and things, but it must have been devastating for so many people in the industry behind the scenes. It's rough.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, I know with our crews and stuff, you know, they're just all, everyone, they're like, we're all in the same boat here, where none of us are having any work. I mean, those that are fortunate that have radio shows and stuff, like Huey and Frank, the drummer, have radio shows, that's cool, because there's always going to be radio. but yeah, someone like Dawn is just a unique soul in the industry, and she's always been someone we really look forward to hanging out with when we get to Amsterdam, and she's definitely fun. So we're very fortunate to have her in our lives, and you as well, it seems. So that's cool. That's what's so cool about, you know, again, music and just being in this industry where you meet people at moments when you don't really know that you need to meet these people, and it's, whether people say it's fate or whatever, but it's yeah, there's a lot of special people out there, and special, and not in the sense in the UK. Whenever I try to say someone's special, it has the wrong meaning here or a different meaning here. So, I mean, that's why I tend to say unique. But yeah, Dawn is, she's a one of a kind, her and Cooper. I was very lucky to meet Cooper when we were leaving Amsterdam. Our DJ left his headphones, and so we went back to pick him up. And of course, Dawn said, oh yeah, I got him. So it was amazing. And then I met Cooper, and he's a wild dog. So I always love seeing her Instagram post with Cooper near some lake in Amsterdam. But yeah, she's cool. She's one of the good ones. And again, I feel bad, because I know over the past few months we've been in contact, and she's been sending me pictures of what Paradiso looks like with these new rules they're trying to do for concerts, where it's basically just a bunch of seats.
Yep.
And a venue like the Paradiso is just, you can't have seats there. You know, there's the balconies, but on the floor, having seats there is just so odd, because the stage is so high, and, you know, capacities and venues are cut 2/3, and that just, you know, it makes it really hard to have that vibe of a show and the energy. So I don't know.
We'll see what happens, eh?
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, you know, for Fun Loving Criminals, it's actually kind of worked out because we don't live in the same towns. You know, Huey and I used to live together in New York, so we could write music really quickly and bounce ideas off each other. But now we're all spread out in the UK. So, you know, we tried years ago with an album, just emailing parts to each other, and it just, the album didn't sound like an album to us. And there's some good songs on it, but we're not the biggest fans of playing that album, where at least now it's like we can kind of, because we're forced in our homes and we all have home studios, we've kind of been able to put together this new record we've been working on slowly, but it's come together quite quickly. So hopefully get it out next year if there's and get some touring going if we can, which is would be good.
I hope so, man. Well, hopefully as well, I'll get out to a show at the Paradiso, and me, you, and Dawn can hang out there and see the town and bring this story full circle. Moments like that, I'm holding out for.
It's a great place. It's a great place to see shows. We always try to see who's playing. I mean, we've seen Cypress Hill in Amsterdam. We've seen a bunch of bands perform there. It's just you get a real unique show out of bands when they play in that town. But you know, we've had similar vibes in other cities as well, so it's not just Amsterdam. But I mean, I think everyone is just dying to go to any show at this point. But only when it can be fun. I mean, it's just remarkable to me that it's like all the government needs to do is get on the news, you know, throw out some numbers, and they can basically do what they want. And I think for the first lockdown, it made sense what they wanted to do. I mean, I disagreed with certain methods, but I think, all right, we'll go along with this, but I just don't think the people in general are going to, you know, fall for it if they say we got to go into a second lockdown. I mean, if this is just really messed up people's mental health, any bit of security anyone's had, and I don't know. I don't know how they could have done it differently, because again, this is some virus that they didn't really know much about. So trying to just keep it light, which seems like it's not possible.
You must have some pretty good club stories from back in the day. Was it the Limelight was the venue you used to work at? And was that with Huey?
Yeah, that's where I met Huey. That was the first. I mean, I went to college at Syracuse University in upstate New York. And I was there for like, you know, a year and a half, got kicked out because I was basically not going to school. I was just being in bands and enjoying like the alternate side of going to college. And I moved into New York City, and I don't even really remember how I decided, ooh, I want to work at this club. But I ended up going to the Limelight and was just amazed. And this was like this is like 1990, and house and techno was kind of taking over. And what I love was, you know, this first night I went there was a Friday night, and it was madness. It was house and techno music, and, you know, all the different rooms they had at the Limelight. I mean, it was thousands of people crushed into this, you know, church that they renovated into a nightclub with a killer sound system and girls in cages and club kids everywhere. I mean, it was madness. I'd never seen anything like it. And then I went back, I think, two nights later on the Sunday, and it was all rock and roll, because Sunday nights is rock and roll church. So it was basically, you know, like kind of your Radiohead machine and Nirvana on the main dance floor with, again, thousands of people. But then in other rooms, there was like a classic rock room, and there was just all different kinds of rock music. And I said, wow, this is actually a really cool club because it's all different music. And then as the weeks went on, I would go back on like a Wednesday or on a Thursday was a good night because it was house music in the main room, but it was like reggae and dancehall in one of the other rooms. And then it was like kind of funk and soul. So I just said, this is so great. And that's totally lost now because, you know, venues, it's like house music. It's pretty much one type of music all the time in a lot of venues and clubs. And I don't even know clubs that are that big anymore apart from Ibiza, but that's where I met Huey. He was a bartender. I ended up getting a job answering phones and being a coat checker. And it was like the first thing he said to me was Fun Loving Criminals. That's the name of the band. And I thought, cool. You know, if it was a friend of his, Graffiti Crew, kind of summarized what we wanted to do with music. You know, we didn't want to start a band because we liked one type of music. We wanted to start a band because we liked all different types of music. You know, I came from this electronic background. Huey came from this blues background, but we had a mutual love for hip hop. So we kind of just blended all the things. And, you know, here we are almost 30 years later and we're still doing it, which is pretty remarkable. So we're blessed in many ways that we've been able to do music that we really enjoy performing and writing. And it's a pretty crazy story. We worked at all these different nightclubs by this one owner, Peter Gation, this Canadian fellow who had an eye patch.
Amazing.
And he was a super, you know, he wasn't the type of guy you wanted to really talk to when he was your boss. He was very intimidating. But at the same time, over the years, as I've come to know him a bit better, especially nowadays, he's a sweetheart. He really was doing something that was was unheard of, and nowadays, you know, you just couldn't do anymore, especially with how clubs and bars are run. But he had something real special there for a long time. I mean, it opened in the early 80s, so, and it was still the limelight through, I think, the latter part of the 90s, and then it just changed, and now they're all closed. But there were some great, you know, Palladium was another one of his venues that now is like dorms for NYU, and he had a renovated train tunnel from back in the days when New York City had trains going through the city. They had this, it's a huge tunnel. He opened a club called The Tunnel, and that's where Sean Combs, you know, Puff Daddy, did his Mecca parties on Sunday nights that were just the greatest hip-hop parties ever, because you'd have Biggie Smalls and Wu-Tang Clan performing there. You'd have Funkmaster Flex DJing and Kid Capri, and it was, as far as hip-hop went, it was next level. So it was just really impressive to work in these venues at this time when it was just a peak of nightclubs in New York, and God knows when they're going to even be able to open clubs and stuff again. But that, those times, I look back on the 90s and think, wow, what a great, easy decade.
I've never been to New York Fest, and I've always been obsessed with it. I need to go, because so much street art, music, like if you think of all the dominant genres in contemporary music, whether it's, you know, hip hop or dance or rock or punk, whatever, and cinema and art, it all seemed to happen in this one city at this, well, I guess kind of the late 60s going into the early 70s was when it all first exploded. But then over time, just new movements, new generations, new eras kept ushering in. And I'm always obsessed with hearing the stories of that city at specific times. So you were there from kind of 90 till the mid 90s, I presume, if not longer. What was it like in that time period, and what was going on? What were the character, who were the characters, what was the sort of the overall vibe that defined the city through your eyes at that time?
I mean, I lived in the suburbs, you know. I wasn't born and raised in New York City, but I lived in the suburbs from 82 until I moved into the city in 90, and lived there till probably 2005-06 before I moved over here. The 80s were great because, you know, we were young, so we'd take a train in and we'd go see like the Beastie Boys perform with like Murphy's Law opening up for them, or, you know, Public Enemy, and just crazy shows. And we'd go to record stores, and, you know, there was always this kind of intimidation factor with New York and with the people as well. And it was just, but still it was like, so there was so much energy that it was just, you wanted to be there. And, you know, it was just an amazing time in the 80s when I moved there. In the 90s, it was, you know, it was still a really just great city to live in. I think what was crazy was you still had like mob hits every now and then. So you'd be walking up the street. We'd be riding BMX bikes all over New York, and you'd see a car blown up. And it probably wasn't even a mob, but you just assumed it was because of John Gotti running around doing all his madness during those couple decades. But it was just a really cool time because everyone sort of met in these clubs, especially like the Limelight stuff, where you'd have musicians, artists, you know, all in different kind of genres, but everyone would be getting together, having a good time. And it was just a really cool collective of people that were all sort of, you know, had the same end goal, which is just not to have to get real jobs.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the thing, is I met some, you know, some really, really amazing people in that decade that, you know, to this day I'm still friends with. And now, you know, a lot of them have normal jobs now, but it's still just to be able to look back on that time, you know, again, when I think of like my daughter, you know, when she's going to get older and think about it, I mean, how hard is life going to be for kids growing up? You know, where are they going to find this inspiration? You know, and it's like, you know, hopefully they will. You know, I don't want to be all morbid and stuff, but it just seems like, for me personally, up until September 11, 2001, life was easy.
Do you feel like that was the exact moment when everything shifted, do you? Were you in New York at that time as well?
Yeah, I was in Brooklyn. I remember, and I got my odd 9/11 stories. This is an interesting one, but it was like, on September 10th, I was visiting my family down in North Carolina, and my dad, had a flagpole. My dad was in the U.S. Navy for a while. He was a very patriotic guy, but he's also a very clever guy. But he had a flagpole. But he was upset because the flagpole wasn't tall enough to fly a flag at half mast.
Yep.
You know how they do that? You know about that? So he said, oh, I really need to get a taller flagpole. And we just had this discussion about, well, it was like a life discussion and about, you know, honoring the past and stuff and learning from the past and all that. But it really focused on this flagpole not being tall enough. So then that evening, I believe, I flew back to New York. And I remember when you fly from North Carolina up to New York City, you fly right by the Twin Towers. So you could see all of lower Manhattan. And I always would look out the window. I would always make sure I'm sitting on the left side of the plane. And there I am looking out the window. There's the skyline. And I remember I'd been there for a few weeks. So when I got back to Brooklyn, I went and partied with my friends all night. Didn't go to bed till like 5 in the morning. And then, you know, a friend came over at 8:30 in the morning banging on our door saying, you're not going to believe this. And we went running over to the promenade in Brooklyn Heights to basically just watch the second building fall down. And it was just like, this is absolute madness. But it seemed like up until that point, there wasn't this like living in fear thing. At least maybe I was lucky growing up in the suburbs and stuff. I never really was like live in fear or worry about doing things because of a fear element. You know, yeah, I knew if I, in the 80s, when I was walking around New York or Times Square in the middle of the night, you know, shit could be kind of hectic. But at the same time, I didn't not go into New York because I was afraid that was going to happen. And after September 11th, there just seemed to be so much pushing of fear that it just seems like it hasn't gotten any better. And the latest one is a pandemic. So it's like, it's bizarre.
I guess it's using that fear as well to usher in subtle, you know, whether it's a new law or just a new attitude or headspace or approach, subtly tweaking and changing so that freedoms are becoming less and less. And as you say, this kind of oppressive cloud just like coming down more and more and more.
It makes you really start to question things more. I've always been into conspiracy theories, and my friend sometimes like, yo, you're crazy. But there's, I always find little bits of truths in them. And I also am smart enough to see where, okay, they're going off on a rant now.
Yeah.
But a lot of stuff just doesn't add up with anything, especially with, you know, 9/11. But I'm not going to be the one going on there putting the blame on things. Until I can see proof and evidence that's, like, irrefutable, I'm not going to really, you know, what am I going to do about it? You know, and there's thousands of people that are in the architects and engineers for 9/11 saying that, you know, the World Trade Center 7 came down through demolition and stuff. And it's all great. It's all great that these people are working their asses off to try and bring the truth out. And if they can actually get that truth to be known, but it just seems like this, the odds are against them in so many ways. You know, God forbid you put out any video on YouTube that questions anything, they just cut you off. So it seems like all the freedoms are getting cut off a lot more. And again, I go back to the 90s when it was like, great, you could smoke weed on the streets, not really get arrested. It was wonderful. And it's like, you know, nowadays it's like, you gotta be careful doing anything. You gotta wear face masks that don't even stop the spread, but it's safer than not wearing face masks.
How did you feel like in the days and then the weeks and, you know, perhaps months as well, how did you feel like the city dealt with what had happened and how it changed the mood in the city and people's attitudes and, you know, behavior? Like, what was the wake of that, you know, awful event?
I think with people, like, one thing New Yorkers know and people that know about New York is it's such a multicultural city, but yet they're all New Yorkers. So like, it never really was a question of like, are you black? Are you white? Are you Asian? Are you Jewish? Are you Muslim? Are you Christian? Whatever. It was just, we're all New Yorkers. And I started getting angry just because once they brought the National Guard into New York, they weren't New Yorkers. The National Guard, I don't know where they scooped them up from, upstate New York. And I'm not saying they're rednecks or white trash or any of that, but I'm just saying, like, I go to drive into the over the Brooklyn Bridge with a car service that me and my friends, we all used, Atlantic Avenue, and they were all awesome cab drivers, but they weren't white. So when we would go over to Brooklyn Bridge, the National Guard would stop. You know, my driver, Felix, was my just a guy I got by random. I never asked for him, but it was this guy, Felix, an awesome dude. And he'd always get questioned. They'd always get him out of the car. They'd search him and everything. I'm like, this is a true New Yorker who's lived here as long as I can remember. And yet some crazy National Guardsman is going to just profile him because he's not white. And just, it was every time we went over to Brooklyn Bridge, I just stopped taking cabs and I felt bad for the guy. Because I know if I had one of the white drivers, we never got stopped. So that was pissing me off because it was like, this is New York. So don't, New York, everything's all different colors, creeds, races, sexual orientations, everything. And we all kind of get along. And it just seems like even nowadays, New York is not that New York anymore. It's like this museum of what New York used to be. And I still enjoy going to New York and visiting, but it's just, the city's changed. I mean, everywhere's changed, but it's like, yeah, it was just hard, and that's when I just decided I'm gonna leave New York, go over to England.
Was that the driving factor? Was it in you moving over here, or one of the main ones?
It was just this creatively. We were, you know, Hugh and I were still working, writing records, but we got dropped by EMI, you know, who had put out four of our records. So it was like it just seemed a lot harder. Everything seemed a lot harder after September 11th. And I'm sure it was, you know, we got dropped in 2000. So it was leading up to that. But it was just, you know, I needed a change because the New York that I fell in love with when I lived in the suburbs and always would go into New York City and the New York, you know, I loved before I even moved to New York in the 70s. I just loved, you know, everything. It was all about getting to New York. But when New York changed, it just seemed like, yeah, I need to get out of the city. So the band had obviously done really well in the UK, and the people in the UK had always been so cool with us and our music. So I said, let's try moving over here one summer. And it was like the summer of 2006. It was an awesome summer because it was just beautiful. It was kind of like the past few months, at least here in the southeast of England, it's, you know, the weather's been really good. So I said, I don't know what people are talking about with the weather being crap here, because it was great. So I moved full time. I moved in like, you know, September of that year at the end of the summer. And then it was just crap weather for like 6 years.
Yeah, then you found out, oh, they were onto something there.
Yeah, I see what they mean. But, you know, whatever. The past, that's one of the blessings, I think, at least for people that live in the Southeast, is the weather's been quite good. I can't speak for the rest of the country, but it's been quite good during all this. So I've managed to get out to the beach, although not Bournemouth, not one of the beaches that have 50,000 people on it. But yeah, it's cool, man.
Why do you think that the British crowds in particular took to your band perhaps more so than they did over in the States?
I think there's an element of how radio, like Radio 1 in particular, was really supportive of us in the early days because they weren't afraid then. Now it's changed a lot with radio, but they weren't afraid then to play, like, you know, a rap song with a guitar solo or a rock song with rapping in it. They weren't afraid, you know, we were being played in the hour that Scooby Snacks would be played. You'd hear a Blur song. You'd hear a Faithless song. You'd hear a Massive Attack song, you know, songs, all different genres, different speeds, different, you know, feels. And it was like, yeah, this is cool. This is amazing. In the States, it wasn't like that. You had your hip-hop station, you had your rock stations, and we did okay with, like, college radio because they played a bit of everything, but it didn't really have the reach outside of that college town, you know? So you didn't really have a national radio, and this is before there was Sirius or XFM and all that stuff. So
yeah,
I think we just got really lucky with radio. The EU was kind of being formed at that time, so there was a lot of money going into countries like in Eastern Europe to fund having concerts and cultural events. So,
do you guys do really well out there as well?
We did then. You know, once the money dried up in the early 2000s, then, you know, the gigs kind of, they just stopped having all these festivals. But we had such a great run from like 96 until, I'd say, 2006. We were still doing a lot of just playing in all different countries. I mean, in the States, you know, we never had these festivals. We had Lollapalooza, And nowadays there's a lot more, but you know, up until the early 2000s, there was weren't many big festivals in different states in America. And here in England, I mean, every weekend there's two or three different ones, some massive ones, some smaller homegrown ones. And the same goes in Europe. So we were just lucky to be able to play for so many people. And, you know, radio was supporting us. So you get people that end up buying your albums. This is before streaming, really, and all that. You know, they'd end up buying your records. Yeah, they ended up buying your records because it was on the radio, not because they, like, dug for it. You know, the drummer in the band, Frank Bambini, he was a fan of the band before, and he, like, actually searched us out and found us. And so he's kind of a more grassroots love for, you know, the music of the band, as opposed to, like, you know, going and picking up a now 25 CD and Scooby Snacks happens to be on it or something. So we just got really lucky, you know, and we also were, there's a bit of skill there because we were doing concerts and kind of fine tuning our music for a live situation, which we never really knew what that would be like. You know, we knew Huey played guitar. We knew that I wanted to play a bunch of different instruments, and we knew we wanted a drummer, but we didn't know how our music would translate to live. And it just seemed like, all right, well, our same philosophy when we were working in the clubs, we're going to take that to doing performances and going on tour, which is, let's make the most of it. Let's live each day to the fullest and try not to have any regrets and, you know, just have a party and have people come to our shows and forget about your problems and let's just have a good time. And I think it really worked. And I mean, nowadays, yeah, we're not necessarily playing the pyramid stage at Glastonbury, but we're playing smaller festivals that you still kind of have that vibe. And it's people that have kind of grown up with our music that are now bringing their kids to our shows, you know, where the kids are all in the back at the bar while the parents are up front, like in the mosh pit or dancing and boogieing. So it's an interesting thing. Cause we did not think when we were writing these songs in our apartment and then going and working at the Limelight that here we are 30 years later and we're still making music. So we're very lucky and we know how lucky we are. And we just can't wait like every other band to just get out on tour. So once they give us the go ahead.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Did Tarantino approve the dialogue sampling in Scooby Snacks?
He did. And that was amazing because we didn't have any rules for what we were sampling back in those days. I mean, the original demos of Confine Yourself are, you know, every song, it's like our Paul's Boutique. Every song has 12, 13 samples in it that, you know, we'd send the song to Phil Collins' people, a little snippet of a thing. And many times the publishers and the songwriters would ask for the lyrics. So we'd send them the lyrics and then they'd say, no, you can't use my sample. So
is that because a lot of the lyrics are, you know, talking about taking drugs and committing crime?
Yeah, stories. They were stories that Huey saw through his, you know, his version of these stories. And that was what was so cool about what I loved about Huey's lyrics, you know, even today, but back in those times, because we were living, growing up in New York City and you know, you saw a lot of shit there in the 90s. I mean, so yeah, with Tarantino, that was just something, you know, we had gotten a record deal and I was just messing around with music and I think I had Reservoir Dogs on the Laserdisc player and I was, I had the Pulp Fiction soundtrack. So I just sampled some dialogue as a joke, sent it to Huey. He's like, oh, this is great. We wrote the song, which was, you know, wasn't had anything to do with Scooby-Doo apart from the name Scooby Snacks. It was about a security guard who worked in the nightclubs who used to give all the security loads of Valium to take on some of the nights that would be very stressful, namely the hip-hop parties at Tunnel. And he'd go up to all the security before the night started and saying, you want a Scooby Snack? You want a Scooby Snack? So we thought, oh, wouldn't it be funny to if you had to go rob a bank, you know, high on Valium. So, and we, when you get in touch with lawyers and publishers, you know, when you're dealing with movie dialogue, it's much harder because you got to get in touch with the movie studios, who wrote the actual dialogue. You got to get permission from multiple places. Luckily with Tarantino, he pretty much runs everything himself. You know, he has a team of lawyers and stuff, but we just had to go to him. And it was great because he was really supportive and we were super thankful. And his lawyers said, oh, you need the right, that you wrote the song with him, which to us, we never had a problem with because he wrote the dialogue. So it's like in the like track IDs and stuff in the liner notes, it said written with Quentin Tarantino, which we thought was great. I mean, to this day, we've never even met him.
Really? Well, it also adds kudos to the track as well. And they both complement each other. Like when you hear that dialogue in your song, it lifts the song, but it also recontextualizes that dialogue in a new setting, which suits it and complements it. And, you know, when you hear your song, it makes me want to go and then watch Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction, you know?
Yeah. And that's what's really why we're so blessed with that song. Cause that obviously that had a big part of, if that dialogue wasn't in that song, I'm not sure it would have been played on Radio 1 as much as it was. I mean, that was at a time when Pulp Fiction was just huge,
yeah.
You know, so, and it was great because his soundtracks are always great. It's always a mixed mash of different music that he listened to growing up. And, you know, we really thought it was great. And he actually turned us on to Robert Rodriguez we wanted Tarantino to do the video. That wasn't going to happen, but Tarantino passed it to his buddy Robert Rodriguez to do it, and there was a treatment written up and everything. It just kind of fell through when Robert Rodriguez realized, I could spend a long time doing a music video, or I could actually go make Desperado. You know, yeah, he can go make feature films. So that didn't work out in the end, but it was just a great time. The 90s, again, the 90s are great. And there was so much good music coming out, you know, especially with, you got your grunge music, you got your hip hop, you got the birth of all the electronic music, you know, and you got the mixed masses stuff, which was cool. Nowadays, it's kind of all the same.
Yeah, and film as well, as you mentioned, like it was such an exciting time for Hollywood film, a real like new era of independent filmmakers coming up, like Rodriguez and Tarantino and Jim Jarmusch. And,
oh, yeah.
I mean, he's just a proper New York, like, you know, icon and institution. Did you see him about much? Was he knocking around when you were in that city at that time?
Every now and then. The one funny show that everyone seemed to go to, and there's like online you can see there's like the guest list. Someone printed the guest list. Was for a Radiohead show at Irving Plaza in New York.
Right.
This is probably 97, 98 maybe. And the guest list is just phenomenal because it's just anyone from the 90s is on that list. And Jim Jarmusch was on it. I didn't see him at the show. I didn't see any of these people at the show because I was probably too blazed out of my mind and probably a bit drunk at that time. You know, it was a social get together, but it's a great list if you could see it. Radiohead guest list, New York, Irving Plaza. If you Google that, you'll see it. It's got like Brad Pitt, it's got Madonna, it's got U2, because we were touring with U2 at the time of that show, so it must have been right around then. But the guest is great. And then for some reason, it was my name they put on the list, so it says Fast Plus Two.
Amazing.
I thought was so great. Yeah, I was very proud of that, and that's rare. Because I'm not, you know, Huey gets recognized and stuff. I never really got recognized, but that was, I got, whoever leaked that guest list, I got more emails and phone calls from people going, yo, have you seen that? And it's like, yeah, all right, that's pretty cool.
I'm going to have to dig that out, man. I want to ask you about John Gotti as well. Did he ever get wind of the King of New York track? Did he ever share any thoughts on that? Did you ever hear anything back?
I don't think he did because he was in prison. I know his son did. And I know his son kind of saw it as a, you know, it was done out of respect for him. It was, again, one of Huey's stories about trying to, like, break John Gotti out of jail and stuff. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily morally the most, you know, the morally correct thing to do, you know, because obviously a lot of people would probably say he's a monster and stuff. But for us, he was an essential character of New York City at the time. So it was obvious that we were going to get an inspiration from him for a song. And I mean, we didn't really have to get permission or anything, because it's like, in many ways, our songs, especially at that time, could almost be seen as parody. Yep. But it was definitely not disrespectful of John Gotti, and we, to this day, would never want to disrespect anyone in that, you know, field, if you will. But it was also, that's what, you know, it's what we were doing, was writing, seeing what's going on around us, writing stories to, you know, music that was a mixed mass of different genres. And, you know, we sort of always saw it as like an album. You know, we were always feel like we're an album band. So it's like, it didn't help with the press saying, oh, these wannabe gangsters and stuff. We weren't wannabe gangsters. Because if you listen to, you know, any of our albums, yes, there's going to be gangster songs, but then there's also going to be songs about love. There's going to be songs that are, you know, smoky-friendly songs and songs, party songs. So it's like, you know, taking little elements and just kind of pigeonholing us, saying, oh, they wear suits and they're wannabe gangsters, when it's like, nah, it couldn't be further from the truth. We wear suits on stage so when our families see pictures of us, we look good.
I think Huey's a unique dude as well, because he can come across as tough and street and authentic, but then he can also sing with soul and with blues and with heart. And
yeah, I think that's the thing. The soul part of it is definitely something that was a big influence in our band, was music that's kind of made you feel a certain way. And that was something that, yeah, he is through and through a New Yorker. So he's crazy out of his mind, but he's also, you know, he is a sweet dude who means well. And that's important, I think. And again, it's kind of rare. It's very easy to let egos get out of control, especially with lead singers. And he's, for the most part, down to earth and, you know, a good dude. So,
do you two have a good relationship?
I think so. You know, we've been friends and been through a lot together over 30 years. So, you know, the fact that we still talk to each other, I think, is important. I think that's one thing with our band, is we never really succumb to the cliched excesses of rock and roll. You know, we smoke weed and we drink booze, but we never graduated to being cokeheads and being heroin addicts and stuff like that. You know, it's like we just always sort of just smoke weed, you know, so we're much more like a Cypress Hill than a Nirvana.
Yeah, I had Be Real on the show about a year or so ago, and just such a cool character, like just one of the coolest people ever. I mean, who would you consider to be Fun Loving Criminals contemporaries and peers from within the music world? Because you straddled so many different sounds and you didn't quite neatly fit anywhere, which is what was great about the band, I think. Did you have any sort of bands that you came up with that you would look to as part of a, you know, a similar story or path or genre or just a friendship circle?
I wouldn't know nowadays. I know that we did some shows early on with Big Audio Dynamite. So we met Mick Jones and obviously The Clash. I think if there was one band that Fun Loving Criminals feel similar to, more in essence than in actual maybe sound, would be The Clash. We love everything about The Clash to this day. So when we did shows with Mick Jones, I personally was loving it because I love Big Audio Dynamite and I love the electronic influences in Big Audio Dynamite, but I also obviously loved The Clash growing up. And by doing those shows, we kind of got to be friends with Mick a bit, and they were great shows. We had good times. Then we were on tour, and we met Joe Strummer. And for Huey, I think he was much more like, if, you know, I think Huey is the Joe Strummer of Fun Loving Criminals, where I'm the Mick Jones of Fun Loving Criminals. And we did a lot of shows with Joe Strummer, and boy, that was just hanging out, drinking whiskey with him and hearing stories and hearing his views on life and stuff, man. It really made a big impression on us, and just they were the best band, and that was like our dream. We were like, all right, we're the band that can get the Clash to go tour, do a reunion tour. We can open up. It's like dream come true. Little did we know, in our being naive, that just ain't gonna happen, you know. And now over the years, I've done the research to realize, yeah, okay, that definitely would not happen. But they're about the only band I think that we would think comes close, because you couldn't really pigeonhole the Clash. Yeah, they were a punk group, but you know, they've done tracks that are pop. They've done tracks that are reggae. They've done, you know, rock. And so they're a band I think just didn't have rules and didn't really have boundaries when it came to writing their music. You know, and they were influenced by what was going on around them. And that was similar. I know, and that's also in many ways a bit arrogant for us to even think that Fun Loving Criminals are in the same league as the Clash. But I think
coming from a similar place, like in terms of your heart and attitude and your view of music and that ability and that want to, you know, delve into a lot of different areas and sounds. And
yeah, definitely. And I mean, there's new bands, you know, obviously it helps with Frank and Huey having radio shows. They're hearing a lot of new music. I'm a retro guy, so like I love spinning vinyl. And I love playing old music and stuff and all different genres of old music, just because you can't really get 7 inches of a lot of new stuff. You can of some stuff, but not a lot. So, I think as far as new bands, I just don't really know many new bands, to be honest. I'm kind of just...
I'm the same, dude. I'm the same. Yeah. I mean, most of the guests that I get on the show are of a certain age. And because I just feel like, especially with a show like this, where you're just going to be chatting to somebody in depth for an hour or so, a lot of the time, like, you know, younger people, newer bands just don't have that same life experience and as much to say. And so I'm not really, you know, actively sourcing younger artists for the show. And then because I'm not doing that, I'm not keeping up to date as much with newer music. And then also really just like an age thing. I think you hit a certain age and you're kind of like, there's so much good old music that I love that I, you know, still need to explore and still need to delve back into, that I can't be bothered to keep up to date with all the new stuff.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'm always still finding new tracks, you know, from the 70s and 80s that I just never knew about. And that's the thing. So I'm keeping myself busy with that. I'm not really looking for new stuff, but I know Huey and Frank would probably be able to say, oh yeah, this new band's great. I know Frank loves Rival Sons.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. They're a good band. They're very Led Zeppelin-esque.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I just feel bad for new bands, especially bands that are going to try and, you know, make a career out of it nowadays with all that's going on, especially lately. Is just back in the days when we were signing a major label, they put so much money into us touring, you know, that we'll be lucky if we ever make a penny off of any sales of those first four records, just because the label spent so much money. But it really helped lay the foundation for us to be able to go do tours, you know, even to this day. And, you know, I just don't think bands will have that these days. They're signing 360 deals, so they're never going to make money on touring like they should, you know, especially with new stuff like Live Nation saying all fees are going to be dropped by 20 or 30%. It's like, it's just going to kill live music. Bands just aren't going to be able to make a living out of it anymore. And, you know, we know it hasn't been easy, you know, even for us to be able to do, you know, we release an album and our tours are a few weeks long now, you know, as opposed to we'd be out all summer. We'd be out for 12, 16 weeks and then go home. And then, like you were saying earlier, it's like go home and just like have such a hard time getting back into normal life, especially when like New York, no one knew who we were. No one gave a fuck who we were. You know, you come from England and stuff, you walk down the street and everyone wants pictures with Huey, and then we go back to New York and it's like, ugh. So it wasn't like a depression would kick in. It was just a completely different life. You know, it was like we woke up from the dream, but we actually were living the dream for many, many years. And I mean, you know, we still enjoy writing music. We still enjoy performing. Definitely performing is where it's at. So that's what just hurts for us and so many other bands. It's just we can't go out and do shows for people. And we're not going to be doing live stream shows and stuff. It's just, you know, we actually talked about it a couple months ago, doing some stuff, and it just didn't make sense. There was no way to make it where it was something we would be proud to do. You know, we could do it and give to charity and all that stuff, but it's like, just didn't work out. So
Yeah, I think if you're going to do it, like the only one I've watched and enjoyed was Dropkick Murphys did a show live from Fenway Stadium in Boston. And that was
really?
That was killer because they performed on the pitch and they did this whole like lead up to it where they explained the history of the team and the stadium and the town. And they got loads of Boston like celebrities, whether they're comedians or actors, to drop in throughout. And it was like a huge, huge production. And it was an arena show, obviously, with no crowd. And that was incredible. But the amount of money that it must have cost, I think they had a sponsor who covered the cost, I think. But the amount of effort and, you know, money that would take to realize something of that scale and that quality, you know, you've got to be so invested rather than just sitting up, you know, either in an empty venue or, you know, even worse, in your front room, just with a camera up.
I mean, I don't even think the three of us talked about whether we really wanted to try and do that. We mentioned it to the managers saying, see what people are feeling. If there's any opportunities, we're open to discuss things, but our management knows it's like, oh, these guys ain't gonna like that, let's not even tell them.
if
you're not playing for people, you know, and feeding off each other, then I don't, there's ulterior motives for doing it, you know, and it's like everyone's suffering to try and get paid these days, so to go do something like that just won't reek, it just won't be genuine just to make, you know, a few thousand pounds, it don't make sense.
Well, hopefully good things happen to those, you know, that wait, and waiting just that little bit longer and holding out. I mean, can you imagine? I'm so excited about playing a proper show again and being on stage again and being in a room with humans again, but I would sooner wait for that and for the right time, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And we all are. We all are waiting however long it is. But I mean, in the meantime, it's like we've got an album that we're finishing up that we're excited for people to hear. You know, the last album we put out was a covers record.
Dude, the Mary Jane, the Tom Petty cover, incredible.
Yeah, I really like that one. That's nice of you. And it's cool because it seems like everybody may have one or two songs on there that they like and the rest are like whatever. And we're exactly the same because that record was more an experiment for us to see what it's going to be like getting into the studio, because before that we didn't put our record until 2010, and that was the one I was telling you about where we basically emailed each other the parts for the record and then emailed it to our engineer in New York to mix. So it wasn't a genuine record that we were proud of, and this covers record was sort of, let's just put that out for now and see what happens. And you know, we were not big fans of that record. But this new one we're writing, we actually are. We're looking forward to doing it. It's original music and stuff we think, you know, with a lot of samples in there, because we went back to the early days of not having the rules, because it seemed like as the laws of sampling changed over the years, our kind of attitude towards, you know, is it really important to use this sample in a song knowing that that person's going to want 100%. Of the ownership of the song now, where it used to be fair in the 90s, you know, we were sampling relatively big bands and they just break it down going, well, it's a small part of just the verses, so we'll take a third of the song. Cool. You know, Tarantino was like, I'll take a third of the song. Cool. Nowadays, it's like you try to clear the littlest thing, they want 100%.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of that thanks to Puff Daddy and
I'll be missing you.
Track. Yeah. It's like Sting said it put him through college, but put more of his kids through college, but it was like, you know, that's not really being creative.
Killed hip-hop in the process as well.
Big time. I mean, it's just like a rip of that song and then just looped over and over and over again. And for us, sampling was more about like manipulating the sound and making multiple samples fit that were in different genres of music. So
yeah, well, it's like using the samples as an instrument, isn't it? And creating something new with that existing, if you want to call it a chord, just taking that, combining it with something else, building something up. I also loved the first Mimosa album that you guys did. That was a huge record for me and my friends growing up. Like, we'd always have that on whenever we were having like barbecues or afternoon smokeouts, or it's that perfect kind of like sunny afternoon party record that we used to session all the time and would love, like the smooth lounge, like chill versions of a lot of those songs.
Train and stuff.
Did Ozzy ever get back to you on his thoughts on that?
No, I mean, that was the thing, is we never really wanted to reach out, and we always went with the Prince situation where we figured no one's going to like it, so we're not going to have people reaching out to him. And but if he did like it, that's awesome. We thought it was really, it was kind of funny. It was all, obviously there's a big element of tongue in cheek with everything we do, but yeah. We love doing that Mimosa record because we recorded most of it in Hawaii. And so writing some music, naturally, if you're in Hawaii, it's going to sound, you know, like that record. So with another Mimosa, it was similar. It was just not written in Hawaii. It was written in central London, more or less, you know, and recorded. So it has a different vibe. But I think a lot of people, when they heard, oh, another Mimosa, great, they thought it was going to be like that record. But yet again, we kind of surprised, but not in the best way with this record. The original one was fun. It's my dad's favorite album of ours. So
yeah, it's a great, I mean, those first three are just for me, like flawless. They still stand up. They sound of their time and yet timeless. And I think they were so synonymous with that time that I think anybody who grew up with them, they were the soundtrack to, you know, really good moments and happier, as you said before, like freer, easier, more relaxed, carefree times.
Yeah, I mean, and at the, you know, we just never really, you never really worried. I mean, obviously a big part of that is when you're young, you think the world is yours, and but obviously as you get older, and when you do have things like children, you get to relive your youth again through your kids' eyes, but at the same time it's just that element of worry. You know, so I guess, you know, we were talking before about how people that have been in this lockdown by themselves, how hard it's been for them. And again, you know, it might have been easier when you're actually being locked down physically with people that are in your family or roommates and stuff. But again, just for kids, it's a crazy world. We worry about kids a lot.
Yeah, it's a trip.
But hopefully, you know, yeah, now that Epstein's dead, and Ghislaine or whatever her name is, she'll probably ain't going to last till her trial next year. But that's a big thing. Big thing is just taking care of kids and trying to provide kids with a future that they can at least just be happy. And at the time being, just be innocent, happy kids. That's the job. Be kids.
I've really enjoyed chatting to you, man. This has been really just chill and really enjoyable, and thank you so much for
That's
taking
cool,
the time
man.
To do it, man. We'll have to do one face to face
later
date, and we'll have to go for a pint sometime as well when the pubs have stopped taking down fucking details and ruining the vibe with PPE screening everywhere.
I went to my first pub yesterday and did the barcode thing and was all excited to order a pint. You know, as I walked through the pub, I saw there's like 15 different draft beer. I was like, this is awesome. And on the little app that came up, the website to order, there was, and this is outrageous for England, but it was literally the only bottled beer was Coors Light and Budweiser. And the only draft beer was Guinness or a like a BrewDog IPA, which was fine for me. But it had so many other great drafts that it was like, oh, no, we don't have that. I was like, but you have it right there. It's like, yeah, but we don't have it hooked up. It's like, damn. So it's like, yeah, pubs are open, but they're not open the way people want them to. But still, I gotta admit, it was kind of nice just to sit outside and have a pint, although social distanced. But it's what it is. But yeah, man, we'll have to do this. Maybe we'll do the face-to-face in Amsterdam then.
Yeah, for sure, man. That sounds like the one. All right, dude.
Matt, yeah, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. And until we meet for real, take care. And
yeah,
man.
You too. Good luck. Good luck, and definitely get out, man. Get out and go for walks and stuff. You're not losing your mind being by yourself. It's the worst.
I just climbed up Snowdon over the weekend, and it was
I saw the pictures. That's amazing.
Incredible. I'm aching all over today, but it's totally worth it.
That's amazing, man. Well, cool. Well, until next time, man, you have a good week, bro.
You too. Cheers, Fast.
All right.
See you in a bit,
man. Take care, man. Bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.